Good afternoon, everybody. It's 2:05. This is Movement Museum. My name's Zeke. I'm here with Allison Elizabeth, and we have a new mover, a museumer, a new person who wants to talk about dance. It's Bettina Farger, who, yes, obviously the adrenaline is coursing through my veins. Bettina, do you have a poem, please?
Oh, I'm starting with a poem? All right, then.
Yes, please.
Okay, of course I have a poem. Yeah,
I tell you, because start, just everything just jumps out and everything goes all out of order.
Okay, what I brought is called Ballet in Flagrante, the Modern Ballet Version by Tony Jolly. They say you'll love it or hate it, and there isn't much room in between. I was sure I was going to squeeze into that slightly grudging middle ground, appreciative of training, skill, strength, grace, movement, and artistic interpretation, but left slightly untouched because I've two left feet and little affinity with the dance floor, and even less for tutus and tights. I was wrong. How I was wrong. Not a tutu in sight last night, but a sublime release of energy in nanodegrees of expression, a perfect continuum between the still and the explosion, beauty at rest and beauty in motion, the epitome of supple gracefulness when need be, shape-shifted at will into a contrasting angularity, an overwhelming sense of shared spirituality, complicity, never so uncouth as to be launching and catching, but all mantra, kata, pushing hands and tai chiing. Bodies at worship of one another, weaving and writhing, slow arcing, space-time warping and bending, rendering gravity's unavoidability a mere inconsequentiality, overcome at will by liberating choreography. I can't begin to explain or even to understand. It didn't work at that level with me. I simply didn't have to disassemble or analyze anything to appreciate its staggering beauty. It embodied the human form and all its potentials and possibilities, entwined in the arms of its lovers, lighting, staging, and musicality, making a love so tender, yet with such intense expression, I felt and shared their in flagrante delicio passion.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Now I'm calm. Now we can go backwards to what we're supposed to do first. Bettina, why the hell do you want to do this?
Oh, well, how about another poem? Why do I want to do this? Well, I've always loved dance because as an artist myself, I'm a visual artist. So I enjoy it on a purely aesthetic level. I see dance as a composition of bodies in time and in space. On a more personal level, I always know that I will be just a spectator in this art. When I go to an art exhibition, I always see it from nearly a professional perspective. The same with film or writing. A poetry reading, always thought, I should listen to what they're doing in case I was going to do something similar. But with dance, like the guy in the poem, two left feet. I will always be in the audience. I can sit back, relax, and criticize. So I'd be here.
Cool. Well, thank you very much. And I'm certain, there will be tougher questions as time progresses.
Okay, bring it.
And we will also learn to talk without making eye contact.
Okay.
But yes, and Allison Elizabeth, how are you doing? You haven't been on microphone at all.
I know. There's somebody else reading the poems these days. It's kind of nice, actually. Mm-hmm. But I'm doing well.
That's good. Movement Museum. We're on Facebook. We're on Twitter. We're on iTunes. You can find us here on CKUT 90.3 FM. And you can find us on the internet at movement-museum.blogspot.com. However, we have a special in-studio guest. Everybody's all giddy and nervous, and that's why I'm just ramming through trying to do everything but. And so, yes, Dominic Port. You got to come closer to the microphone.
Hi, I'm coming.
And yes, we have Dominic Port from System Day, the power behind all of that in studio for a whole, wonderful, oops, bang, bang, bang. I just can see I'm nervous. Thank you very much for coming in.
Hi, you're welcome. I'm nervous too, actually.
We can be nervous together.
Yeah, good.
Okay. First question. Do either of you guys have any questions for her?
Oh, my goodness. I'm going to jump right in.
Or would you like me to ease in and sort of start off with something?
Well, I can ask.
Okay.
I mean, just reading through your bio and stuff like that, what was the catalyst for you going from doing solo work into doing group pieces like the piece that we saw last week, Ulysses Nous et les Sirènes? And how did you make that transition from dancing your own solo work to inviting more dancers into the piece with you?
It was not a radical transition. It came after which many different work where, like as a wave, I'm going from solo to group, solo to group pieces. And what happened with Ulysses Nous et les Sirènes is a fact, I could say, is the first piece I wanted to consider each person as a soloist. I love making pieces a little bit like orchestra, but I love space. I love when I have 15 dancers and really using, you know, like movement. And my first interest for this piece was definitely the interpretation, even if I gave and I developed with each of them a vocabulary, which I'm doing that since a long, long time. But the fact also the dancer had all her life behind them, you always have your life in front also, you not just behind, but they're mature, they're not 20 years old. So I love the fact, you know, when you're not so young, you also, you have to deal also with more the reality of who is a person as a human being, in our body, but in our brain, in our mind, with all this. So to me, before to meet together, it was to go back to solo. And the best way to meet is to explore who you are alone. That's why for the music and for the dance, it's exactly the way we worked. Like I could name like Laurent Masley and Charles Papazov for the two composers and the two singers, which are Isabel Ligo and Nadine Medawar. And with this team, we really try musically to meet and to play. And we really start to, with 2 weeks residency, just playing and just go with all the luggage you have, you know, as an artist, and not to define too much. I'm coming from this and you're coming from, yes, I'm coming from this and I'm coming from that. And even if I'm talking blah, blah now, we didn't really talk too much for 2 weeks. It was more like immersion. And from this residency, and we try, and I have different structure. I structure my rehearsal in different way with approach and improvisation and composition. After that only, I felt, these voices is still in my mind. And I was in France, and I was close to the ocean. And I was like, wow. I don't know. I want to come back to explore a story which is far away. And that's why I came back to Odyssey and my imagination start to work.
Fantastic.
Mm-hmm. And so the process was you basically started in just in residency, and then was it you directing them saying, this is what I feel, and it then flowed, or?
I had four tea boxes, which I put just small paper. The first box was a word regarding space. The second one was regarding sounds. The third one was regarding bodies. And the last one was regarding rhythm and situation. So sometimes we were using rhythm, which can be used for singing or inspiration with our body, and reversed. So I really liked this kind of structure boxes, and we explore a lot with 2-3 minutes each time, you know, just to not, because it was a lot to manage, and I felt, oh my God, we start to go be a collective, and this is not the direction it will be good. But also Laurent Masley, he arrived with a lot of different groove and in his computer, different stuff, new and old. And first it was just warm up. Okay, from your warm up, just pick it up. Okay, try. Only one person ahead by each improvisation. So it was kind of structure with the idea to not judge the result, because sometimes you're like, no, it's not about test. Just open, and after you will go to direction.
And so then you'd basically do something, he'd be working on music at the same time, and then after everything was done, it obviously did need to be judged, so as to say, this we're going to stick with, this we're not. Were you videotaping all the rehearsals and then going back and looking at them like you do on a film and say the rushes, no, we have to go redo that scene? Or was it sort of much more organically, this is how I feel about this piece or this set of moves that I'm doing, and that's how you got them?
When, after these 2 weeks of residency, let's say on a CD, all the music was recording. And as premise, like just, you know, when you start something and you feel, oh, I love this voice, and the musician are like, but it's nothing. And sometimes they're like, oh, I love what you have on videotape. And I was like, no, it looks like nothing. So work is important, of course. So just to decide what you want to keep at the beginning. Okay, after this first residency, I came back with no music for 3 weeks. So it was a little bit getting out of a big party or something when you feel, okay, let's go back to silence. The piece is not done yet. We had fun. It looks full, because as soon as you just go and go, and instead to be trying to remember movement, which I love, but I mean, it's a process, right? So it takes more time and you don't know what you use or not. Okay, I was like, okay, now let's work. And it was fun. Everything was possible. So we were in silence. After these 3 weeks, I gave the video to the composer, and already they say, okay, we will never be working, let's say for a while, you work from your stuff and we will give you music after. So let's say I have a chunk of 15 minutes. The only thing I say, I would love to have the feminine voice on Mark, and I would love to have groove more on at one point of the woman, and after it changed. But it was more about which sound is connected to which dancer, you know, like really basic. And after that, the two composers really worked with many different level, with videos and adjust. And it was a lot of stop and go. Or, for example, to make it simple, as you say, as a film, twice I was with the two composers and we realized it's nice you work with the video, but let's put all the music 3 minutes ahead, or let's devise, because after a while we were so much connected, it was just too much, everything on the same level. So let's say we work that way.
Okay, and then once you had, and yet, Bettina, you can jump in any time, and that noises in the background are a bunch of other dancers showing up. We'll speak to you guys later. But then it's, you had a large thing, I imagine. Then was that then the finished product, or the finished piece, or the finished performance, or were there other than processes that then got added in, taken out, and sort of once you had this sort of format and the music in?
What happened is, like, we were not able to have the singers all time, and because of that, we worked separately a long time. So it was never finished. It was always a process of having the music. And what was difficult after a while is, like, you know, it's not finished, but you get used to it and you accept. And after a while, it was like, but no, it's not finished. So it was this kind of, okay, but later we know it will be live. So when, let's say in December, it was the last part of the music, and we had a small residency all together. It was like, okay, it's achieved. But it took different strat also, because I did a piece a few years ago where they were also live, and this time they were already trying to say, you need music to work, go with your ID, come back to me, and let's see if after you want to sell the show, maybe you need a soundtrack also to be sure. If you don't have money to have the singers, do you need it or not? Depends on that. You know, it was also this aspect of where we put the piece after Place des Arts. And so let's say it took a long, long time before it was really, really finished.
Where is it going elsewhere?
Hmm?
Or what are the plans for the future with it?
Oh, I talked already with different Maison La Culture. I'm going to Quebec City next week because I have really positive feedback from producers. Mm-hmm. So definitely we want to explore Quebec. Also Toronto and some in Europe. But let's say I have to make my video
okay.
first.
Okay. Bettina, do you have any questions?
Yes, actually. I was wondering how close you felt that you stuck to the original story of Ulysses. I know it's the title, and you had the one man and the three women on stage, and obviously the male role was the Ulysses and the sirens. And we talked about the music that, I guess, was the siren songs that drew him in. But apart from that, what elements did you focus on? Or was it more just a starting point, and then you kind of went your own way?
It was a starting point, but also it was a big reference in a really philosophic and metaphoric way for all the process. I like the chaotic aspect of how he has been written. Like, for example, you could suspend a character during the time you're traveling somewhere else. You know, like, just physically, like, oh, we don't know what to do with this character. Oh, just make him sleep for a while. We will be back. So this kind of that. So he will influence me with the aspect of the rhythm in a piece, you know, like if it's moving and suspend, or he inspire me about maybe in a more metaphoric way, as far we are victim or not, to provoke the movement, as far we... Is it another voice, or is it the sound? Fall in a body.
Right. So sort of the sound of the siren fills you.
Yeah, fills you.
With
thank
passion,
you. Yes.
Or desire.
Yeah.
I felt when I saw the sirens dance that they seemed to be overpowered by their own desire or strength.
They don't listen to us.
I could tell it was obviously not a flaw of technique, but you know, they were on their on their toes, and you know, they seemed unstable, and they needed Ulysses even to hold them up. Mm-hmm. This is not what I thought a siren was. I thought they were very strong women who make men kill themselves, you know, because they're just so enraptured. So I was interested in knowing what your take is on the siren.
No, for sure. That way, I was not, of course, closed on a book or trying to remember exactly, you know, when Ulysses started to ignore. You know, I didn't go that way. It was more, first, to me, for sure, you know, there is one man and three women, but also I felt what part of us is Ulysses and what part of us is a siren. And as far sometimes you have a reference which is really concrete because physically it looks what it is, mm-hmm. and sometimes it is more the idea of going just outside of home or herself, you know?
Yes.
And that way, in this aspect, I think everybody has had the same role, like with the power to just get out or not. But it was not this direct sense
of... Not a strong dichotomy.
Yeah.
You felt that they were interchangeable, and sometimes Ulysses could be a siren, vice versa. I even felt that the sirens amongst themselves tended to have very distinct characters.
Yeah.
There was one who was always more in the supporting roles. Others seemed to be more lyrical and fluid. Was that just my perspective, or did you choreograph it that way?
No, actually, I went with their personalities too. You know, like... and naturally, it's exactly the same thing also with the interpret. It's like Nadine has something much... sweet and delicate, and Isabelle is more like she's coming from opera and she's really like more, and the fact to be more fragile or stronger is also an aspect to be
I can translate.
C'est une manière aussi d'être fort, d'attirer.
To be the person of strength, pull the other one.
Yeah, to go further with what you are is the best way
you take a risk.
Somehow. And maybe that's why. Hmm. That's why he was not this emphasy of really having a role. He was more pushing more who you are.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And this is strong and present.
Mm-hmm. I think that made the whole ballet less predictable. Because when you read the title and you know the story, you say, it's obviously going to be this. And you see the dancers arrive and say, it's kind of a foregone conclusion. Yeah. But I noticed that you turned a couple of elements on their head.
Yeah.
So I thought it was interesting. I also noticed that the dancers were working in beautiful symmetry sometimes, but mostly they were dancing next to each other, not really with each other, not really looking at each other, not really touching each other. And for me, it felt very urban at first.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like the big city feel, we're all next to each other, mm-mm, we're not really looking at each other. And I wondered if that was something that you had sort of written in, or if that's just because it's just something I saw in it.
You saw that, but the way it happened is the fact sometime I wanted us more being like a cells, no, biologic, like if we were less a human being and more like a wave or something more abstract, or an energy on stage, you know, like just a reminiscence of something. And from the beginning, I always thought if this story is so universal, we could all make our own story and in reference with that, but also it has to talk to us until today.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow, even in a book, you know, sometimes they say, where are you, God? Are you God? Are you just a human being? And I don't know if it means just to be a human being is not to be connected really with others, but there is a sense of his reality. He didn't come just because I thought, oh, it's urban. He came more because sometimes I thought, we're not responsible to move. The space make us move. And the fact the space make us move, we don't have this presence as outside. We just like...
You're just going with the flow.
Exactly. Let's go with the flow at the end.
Yeah, I thought that was very beautiful. That's also a beautiful way of having people dance together.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that.
Thanks.
You're obviously like incredibly inspired by the people that you work with, and you have an amazing team. How do you choose? How do you know who you want to work with and who
will serve
you?
Did we really choose? Are we able to do that? No, I'm kidding. All these people are really close to me. I really wanted to do a piece. It could be like professionally or in my life. You know, it was not my best friend, like let's say one of the dancers, but she didn't dance for 9 years. And I was like, okay, let's go back with you today. It was also important, the issue for each artist in this piece at this moment in their life. The two composers, I work with them once, Laurent Maslet, we worked together since 15 years. Charles Papazov, we worked since 2004. And with Plusol Consolo, they were on stage, they were cheering also, they were co-compositor. And this time to me, it was to go further with this adventure, to put them together and to feel, but also with two singers. And Marc Boivin, I worked with him before, and I don't have like a big company where I could work all the year long. And to me, the way to go back with people I really know from different projects is super important. So like Victoria May, she was in Plusol Consolo. I met her 3 years ago. So everybody was connected somehow, even to be disconnected or not really, let's say on the same road, because they were more a lonely or individual piece. But yeah, that's why I decided to work with them. Marc Tétrault, the lighting designer, it was the first time. And sometimes, sometimes you just like fall in love. You feel like, oh yes, you today. Okay. Yes, it's now, you know. No, I didn't,
Okay, thank you.
And what was, it's sort of a two-part question. So it's because, yes, we will have to get to you guys very, very soon. So this is the last question. What was the easiest part of putting the show together? And the flip side, what was the toughest part of putting the show together?
Mm-hmm. So far, so good, so closed, so whatever. No, I don't know. The tough part, it was a long, long process. Because last year it was also problem financial with money, and so to delay that, what you start to create, you have start to judge even more. You know, it's not like doing a painting, and it's a reverse and a IQ or Japanese or Chinese calligraphy. You know, you don't have this big one. You have to. So this was tough, but it was really rich. It's like if you accept also with time, you do something and you let it go, like some dust on it, and you clean again, and you have some dust again, and you clean again. Mm-hmm. And you ask a question again, and I say, yes, I want this again. Okay, good. So this was tough and rich. The light part, I would say I was really lucky to have so much support, especially from Place des Arts with the weeks of the residencies, the time we had in a theater, the time we got also by the company Overtigo, and La 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 Human Steps. I felt a lot of support. And so it's not directly what it was easiest in a piece during the process, but more, oh wow, you know, this project had a lot of support now. We know the boat was going down.
And now it's suddenly coming back.
Yeah, the ocean are still alive.
Cool. Well, thank you. You're welcome to stay. We have, as you can see, other people as well. We have, a couple of bills to pay and stuff like that. And we'll be back in a minute with new voices in your head. I've heard that line before someplace else. Howdy. We're back. We got more voices on the air. This is Movement Museum. My name is Zeke. I'm here with Allison Elizabeth. I'm here with Bettina, and Dominic now may jump in because she's still in the room and she's got a microphone, and she saw the show as well. And yes, Dominic, thank you again.
Thank you very much.
Port from System D, who did Ulysses, Us, and the Sirens. But now we got some folks from out of town. I have no idea what your name is, and I apologize. Can you introduce yourselves, please?
That's okay. I'm Gavin.
You're Gavin, and...
I'm Gabriel.
And you guys are from Splinter Group.
Yeah, from Australia.
That we can tell by the voice.
Where in Australia?
Well, we're kind of based around all over the place. In fact, like, this show was co-produced between Germany and Australia. So I've been based in Brisbane in Australia. One of the cast members based in Berlin. Gabrielle's in Melbourne. But we tend to kind of work all over the place.
Cool.
And you guys are doing Roadkill, and so as we can get all that stuff out of the way, Roadkill is at Sanctum Sal. It's on from now until Saturday. Tickets, if you are under 30 years of age, are dirt cheap. Unfortunately, I'm not under 30 years. Shucks. But yeah, thanks for coming in. Yeah, Alice and Elizabeth, you want to start the questions off again?
Okay, unfortunately, I didn't get a chance to see your show, so my questions
are... I forgot. I'm sorry.
I do have questions,
what
though,
the show is.
Because I was super intrigued by the clip that I saw on the interweb. And my question is the theatrics or dance first for you?
Yeah, it's a good question, actually, I guess, for us. I mean, I think our motivation is to actually find... a purpose for the dance to exist in the first place, but we don't want to, we still want to actually move, believe it or not, we're still pushing an idea of movement, but the starting point for that movement needs to come from a kind of theatrical purpose first. It's got to serve some purpose apart from just liking the movement, actually. So I would say that in a way the theatrical impetus comes first and then the dance vocabulary comes out of that.
Well, that kind of links to my second question, too, is about concept. Did it come from... Because I know a lot of dance kind of comes from one point of inspiration and grows from there and changes and evolves and whatnot. And if it's a more theatrical-based or a plot-based piece, is it was it a consistent concept throughout the process?
No, it comes... I mean, the actual... I guess the beginning point changes depending on the show that we're making. Often it will come from an image or something like that. For sure, this piece came partly in a response of returning to Australia after being in Europe. And we'd actually just made a show about, which was based in a Berlin apartment, was really based on the kind of claustrophobia of living in Europe in winter for the first time and the response to that and this kind of... So going back to Australia, the sense of agoraphobia and this massive landscape then gave rise to all these kind of ideas of an urban myths and so on. So the stories kind of come, but in fact the first is actually sometimes as simple as a photograph. I took a photograph of a phone box and a car actually just one night when I was in Australia and became fascinated with these kind of objects that are just glowing in the space, and it's a bit of a Gregory Crutzen, it was my own attempt at Gregory Crutzen photo, and that became kind of like a beginning point, really, actually, these two objects too. So it really depends on where we're coming from, but then we looked then in deeply into some of the stories and of backpackers that have disappeared in Australia and been bizarrely murdered, or their bodies have just disappeared and never turned up again. And in particular, there was one case of a British backpacker called Peter Falconio that we started really looking into closely. And the piece is not based on that story, but we just used everything we could find, basically, to feed kind of our own fascination with the subject matter.
I'm even more intrigued now. That sounds fascinating.
Yeah, it reminded me a lot of those kind of horror movies, especially the lighting and the props that you used were nearly like characters in themselves, especially these cuts where you had that... There's just the two of you in the studio now, but there's a third guy, right? Your evil
Don't
shadow.
Don't give it away.
who suddenly sort of sometimes pops up, you know, flash, there he is, flash, he's gone. Yeah, and that's very cinematographic. Yeah. Is that really that narrative that inspired the...
Not so much the narrative, but the idea of cinema. We're always kind of inspired by film, I guess, in all of the work we've done. And sorry, I'm talking more than Gab at the moment because we actually made the piece with another girl that Gab's replacing on this tour. So Gab doesn't actually know so much about the beginning point of it. So I feel she's the ring in. But so I'll keep mouthing off anyway. So basically, film is a massive inspiration, but with this piece we decided to take a little further, that we wanted to make something like a kind of film, I guess, or inspired more David Lynch style film than kind of narrative film, but we wanted to actually try and find out how can we do the things that we love about film on stage, because the medium is completely different. We're not trying to make a film on stage, we were talking about edits even, like mm-hmm. that we do kind of wipe edits, we do snaps, we do all this kind of stuff, but how physically can you make a wipe edit on stage with bodies and with... And so the drive, there's a driving scene where we just carry the trees. Of course, the car doesn't move anywhere.
That was great. Yeah. I love that.
So we kind of, it was all this thing of how do we represent these things that you would see in a film. And one of the ones that was most important to us was this idea of a first-person perspective, a close-up. And we'd always talk about whether, also with Luke, our sound designer, whether something is a close-up or whether it's a long shot, you know, a wide shot, and that this really fed. And one of the first things we actually unlocked was this idea of how you can make a close-up of Gab when she's in the car. When you're sitting in the audience and you're all the same distance away from her, how can it be the same as a close-up in the rear vision mirror that you would get in a film? And that's where we worked out kind of ideas with sound to use that actually you only hear her inside the car. So the idea that you're talking outside, you don't hear it until you wind down the window and then you start to talk actually live. So you're actually kind of playing with the ideas of sound to create kind of film film kind of devices on stage. So that was really a huge beginning point for us and one we wanted to push as far as we could with this and with the lighting, with the sound, with everything.
Just for my mind, was there actually video used in the piece or was it just the aesthetic?
No, there's no video. It's just actually, yeah, it's completely, I mean, I think there's times when it looks kind of like a film or maybe you're, but of course it is live theatre, so we don't want to make it look like a film where you get distanced from it like you do, I guess. You know, you feel safer in a film. We didn't really want to make people feel safe either.
Now, have you guys seen Sleuth?
No.
It's originally a stage play by some guy who won like really... big prize, but I'm not going to remember his name, but then got turned into a film with Michael Caine and Laurence Olivier. And it struck me as being, as far as that sort of bringing people in and the sort of just sucking them into the stuff, it was very similar to. And yeah, get a DVD of it. I can give you the information.
Okay. You can pass it on.
It's very, very nice. Yeah. It's, and Allison, you took all my questions.
No, sorry.
That's okay. It's okay. It's a nice thing. And Dominic, if you have questions, jump in as well. They're on a very sort of pragmatic level. The stones, the hail. Was it stones? Was it hail? And yeah, I got confused when you guys started throwing it at each other.
Yeah.
Snowball fight in Australia. Lester heard you don't have snow.
Oh, that might happen.
Yeah, well, I mean, everything that we're using in the piece, we're trying to keep a certain ambiguity. We don't really want the audience to lock onto meaning. I mean, at the beginning of the piece, we set up, obviously, a very linear kind of path, but very quickly we fracture off into a million possibilities. So certainly there's a lot of things the stones were representing to us. One thing was also just to bring this sense of the desert, of the outback, into the theatre, to actually... find a way to represent that. And having the stones on the floor and the long shadows of them and stuff, there's something within that, and also that natural element that you're bringing in, because we're trying to represent something that's obviously huge and natural and not at all something you find in the theater, I guess, unless it's in your imagination. So we want to bring an element of that in. There's also something of the dryness and this heaviness of them that they're weighing down the body, in fact. So this, because we play a lot with the sense of agoraphobia as being a physical manifestation of it, that actually you have the feeling that you're floating away, because it's if you've ever been out in a massive desert at night, you, particularly in Australia in the outback, you see, you can see if there's a town 500 kilometres away, but it seems like it's over the crest of over the roundness of the earth, that you can see a glow. And the stars are so big, you really get a sense that you're just on a lump of rock that's floating in space. You feel like you're in space, actually. So you actually get a little freaked out and that you're going to fly off and disappear in this kind of immensity of it. You can see the distances between the stars and all that kind of stuff. So we use that physically in the piece, that sense of floating away, and the rocks are really something to kind of weight you down as well. And then there's also kind of all these images of being buried in stones and having kind of the stones wash over you, the kind of sands of time. So we kind of used it in a million different ways. But whether it's a hailstorm, it's also a little bit like Magnolia.
Yeah, where the frogs fall.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The other thing with the Stones too that came up actually in a Q&A when we were in Toronto is one of the audience members really felt that they were like representing the stars, because when you're in really wide open spaces, there's something that become, you know, really present. And to go along with the floating idea, there's a lot of scenes where I'm either floating away or being kind of pushed down again, brought back to Earth by either the rocks or Gavin. And towards the end of the piece, it's actually quite dark on the scene, and you just have it littered with these little, you know, white rocks, which actually, it, as a performer, it is quite the sense that perhaps you're floating in the sky or something like that. And that sort of seems to be one of the recurring images that we get occasionally from audiences. So
I hadn't made the connection between the stars, but now that you mention it, it makes perfect sense.
Yeah, this was someone who actually watched it for the first time from higher up in the balcony in Toronto. So she was really looking down on the piece, and that's when she got that strong kind of impression.
Yeah, I actually really liked that too, because it made it sort of made something click that I hadn't thought of about performing the piece as well, which is always interesting.
Yeah, speaking of performing it, it's you made the switch over, because my understanding is that you, the three of, not the three of you, Gavin, you and two others sort of co-made it, co-choreographed it together as sort of like a communal thing, and then Gabrielle, you got dumped into it?
Yeah, literally.
How did that happen? How did taking somebody's shoes like that?
Yeah, well, I mean, it happened because Gavin and Grayson both know me as a performer and as a person, and Gavin and I have worked together before, so it was kind of, I guess, a logical sort of replacement because of also the kind of physicality I have in comparison to Sarah Jane, who's the one who made it. But in terms of a performer coming into it, it the nice thing, I suppose, about Splinter Group is because it is really this collective sort of atmosphere that even if you come in as a replacement, you're really coming with whatever you want to add to the piece and bring to the piece. So it's the way I interpret it is very different, I think, to the way Sarah Jane does, although I've tried to stay true to like her intentions and her movement and stuff. Things have changed a lot, actually, from what the original role is, I suppose. But that's also a bit the thing with the performance, with any performance, I think, that Splinter Group does, is it continually evolves as it's being performed. So if you saw one at the beginning of when it was first premiered and you saw one 3 years later, like, there can be some pretty significant changes because it's an evolving process.
Bettina, do you have anything? Dominique?
I wonder if you guys have theatrical training. Because your pacing on stage, it was so deliberate, you know, that there's a minimal movement that told an entire atmosphere and narrative. So
I mean, we've all worked in dance theatre companies and kind of European dance theatre companies, I guess, where there's a blurred line between whether you're acting and dancing, you're usually being asked to do both. And that's been certainly my whole career. And so certainly I think, like, for us, it's not really a point of whether we are, although we did come up with our own term for what we do, which was dacting.
Dacting.
Because it's kind of, it's neither dancing nor acting. It's kind of in between. So we thought we'd coin a term for it. So dacting.
And I like the fact that the dance comes first.
Yeah.
Well, it's not the easiest thing, you know, because also what we're doing mostly doesn't involve words, which actually in my experience of being a dance theatre performer, usually the acting side of it is you have a lot of text. So to sort of do it just through your interaction is actually, it's quite challenging.
Yeah, we had someone early on describe one of our pieces as basically like a piece of theatre, but told through movement. And I think it's quite very simple, quite in a way to describe it, but actually I think it's quite true. So we don't necessarily try and we'll use text obviously as well, but it's more we use whatever device we kind of feel like will feed the actual work itself. So we kind of, we're willing to play with anything. We haven't done a musical yet.
Okay. Well, speaking of devices, I want to know what's in that telephone booth.
Nothing. It's an anti-gravity chamber.
Specially made.
That I know. That costs a lot.
I can imagine. Initially, I was sort of saying, you guys could have picked up a junk heap scrap car here to ship it across the ocean. That's like ridiculous.
No, but then you realize there's a lot more going on in there.
Yeah.
And then also, because I saw Sasha Waltz when they were here for the FTA. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to space on the name, but there was the sort of the thing, the
Kerpa was the piece.
Yes, Kerpa. Yeah. Yes, exactly. is everybody except the Canadians doing this sort of like sliding on glass stuff and using chambers and we're just late to the party?
I forgot that Kirpa has an element of that. I mean, Grayson was in that piece as well. Grayson kind of, I think in a lot of work he's done, he's also fed those kind of things in the places where he's worked as well, because he has this ability and this strength. We have another show in Berlin apartment, and he spends half his time climbing on the walls and stuff, and it's very beautiful. So there was always, when we were making it and stuff, there was always kind of, okay, the phone box is a perfect little place for Grayson to play in. And again, it's that weightlessness that feeds the piece, so it was completely something that kind of just came out of that, I guess, more than anything. It's really beautiful to watch, and it's kind of mesmerizing and hypnotic for sure.
I guess too, also, it's like Gavin was saying before, what you tend to bring to the piece in the making of it is the things that you're interested in. So if you start from scratch, you have, like a premise, but it's also everyone bringing in the things that excites them and that they're really, you know, into. So it makes sense that if we all also work with other people and for other companies and stuff, that you're, again, you're bringing the things that you like and you're interested in. So it's sort of, I guess the more people or companies you work with, the more those little things get out there, so then you'll see six pieces with someone sliding down a window because someone's really, really into it.
It is absolutely spectacular. Yeah. His moves. And then, speaking of, again, details, how long did you guys practice on that kissing in the car?
Oh, you know, I like to try and rehearse it every day. But
not the sex.
Not the sex. That's the one that I try and rehearse.
For me, probably about 10, maybe 15 minutes.
Yeah. That's it?
Yeah. Wow. I didn't have very long to actually learn the piece, so...
Gab just came in, and we had, like, 4 days in Toronto before we opened.
I'm picking my jaw up off the floor. I'm amazed. I first was amazed when you jumped into his arm.
Right.
Because that's like... That hurts if you miss.
Yeah, okay.
And then realize you had 4 days?
Yeah, 4 days. I mean, we're lucky because we just came off a gig where we were working together. Although I have to say, I'd actually... Even though we're on stage together, I don't really remember dancing with you. So this has
I picked you up. I lifted you around.
A couple of times. But it counts. It's not really the same.
It's a really practical, but, you know, I was really amazed at the beginning of the show. I was like, oh, is a car, is a set, they bring everywhere? That's silly to know, you know, but when you know what it is to travel with that, I was like, really?
It's a funny thing. I mean, we kind of addicted a little bit to objects and to physical things also in a lot of different ways for it to be a kind of anchor for the audience, because you have the abstraction of dance, which we love, but we always want to find an anchor point for that to come from, which is this kind of idea of where the movement comes from actually as well. So we are like, we did a piece with a Berlin apartment with three walls you can climb on, and it was just a nightmare to tour it. Half the time it didn't fit in venues and stuff, so you always restrict yourself a little bit with set. But there's a big difference, I guess, if you're working in Germany and stuff, everybody builds massive sets and tours them around and stuff. But I think certainly in Australia and probably more in America and maybe Canada as well, the people don't tend to go with sets as much for us, and it's simply because of money and how much money people have to bring you and transport all that.
Which is also somehow why the work differs so much, you know, like Canada, America and Australia in general, as a mass generalisation, are way more interested in exploring pure movement and ideas of, like, you know, physicality and stuff, whereas coming from, like, a European perspective, because you do have more resources and you can build your big set and you can play in your big set, you get a different sort of sensibility of the work because it's normal to be involved with those kind of things, where perhaps in these other countries you're more focused on what you've got because, you know, you don't have a massive set.
It's the sort of thing. I will refrain from making the bad joke about it being a Toyota. Because the car is a Toyota and...
Toyota Corolla.
Corolla.
But there with the recalls and everything like that.
It's true. I didn't even think about that. How topical we are.
But when you started it, I assume you had planned on touring it from the get-go. Was there ever any thought of localizing it, making it sort of... Because it wasn't until after I saw it where I realized, yes, there are these sort of mythic ideas of the outback to the Australian psyche idea, sense of identity. There are similar ones in Canada. There are similar ones in the States. I'm certain there's similar ones in South Africa and any place that have a rather... Luxembourg doesn't have any of those, I don't think. But did you say we need to make it Australian entirely, or...
I mean, it's our perspective, so it's obviously an Australian take on it. I mean, you just hope that the themes you're dealing with and the kind of story itself has a universal factor that people will connect with that's bigger than it just being an Australian yarn kind of thing. So, yeah, so it's not that we ever thought about making a kind of English version where you get, like, broken down Vauxhall or something out in some little country lane and you get some sheep farmer come along or something.
Yeah.
No, we know, and changing accents and stuff like that.
No, like, that would be really hard.
That would be bad.
And also, if you look at, like, lots of the props, they're also really quintessentially Australian, like the can of Bundy and cola. Like, you know, we didn't sort of change that for different places also because it's like this is your window to the Australian version and you do the translation for the Canadian equivalent.
And it's that thing of loving kind of those little things like the Bundy and cola, you know, like which those little kind of Australiana elements of it we really love putting in. And it's the same when we did the Berlin apartment. We also loved having little Australian elements or German elements. We're kind of fascinated with these kind of little kitschy things as well. So it kind of satisfies us.
I think my asking the question was sort of upon realizing that, oh, it is a part of the Australian, but then realizing that there are connections all over the place, and I'm making the connections myself. You guys obviously don't have to, but I was just hoping you could do a Canadian version.
It was kind of very interesting for us because we sold this piece at the Australian Performing Arts Market, and then we got a big tour up in Australia for it, and then actually the main tour that came out of it as well was this Canadian tour. So it was very clear for us out of all the presenters that it was a lot of Canadians who were connecting with the piece, actually. And I think it's simply you have a very similar landscape. Not similar landscape, I guess, but a similar idea that you're all living in one place and behind you is this massive emptiness that could consume and kill you at any moment if you venture into it. And there's something in the psyche growing up with that that's kind of very fundamental. And it was what, I guess, by being in Europe and stuff, you realize that it's not there. You can wander off in Europe and you'll just find another town.
I'm always amazed at how small their places where they live are.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Is that they can fit into something that's like the size of my fist.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's not that they don't have beautiful nature and stuff. They do. It's just actually they don't have a wilderness. Like, and that sense of a wilderness existing that is dangerous is kind of something that feeds this urban myth and all the stories you grow up with as a kid and that you tell around the campfire to try and scare each other and all that kind of stuff. And that's really... was that childhood fascination that we were kind of beginning with, I guess.
Cool. Primetime just showed up. The next show is here, Positive Vibes. We're going to have to wrap this up. I'd like to thank Gabrielle and Gavin for showing up. They are part of Roadkill. They are part of Splinter Group. That's through Saturday at Sankyum Sal. And if you are a youngster, it's cheap. If you're not a youngster, it's still cheap, but not as cheap. And then Bettina and Allison Elizabeth, you have stuff by help me, please.
Well, we have stuff to announce, right? Because there are things going on. Lucie Grégoire Danse.
Yes, she's going to be on next week.
That's great. They present 20 dancers on top of Mont-Royal on February 27th and 28th for the final segment of Lucie Grégoire's choreographic journey, Le Retour du Temps. So that sounds great.
And then the Grand Ballet stuff?
Hang on. The Grand Ballet, that's a romantic ballet par excellence by the Guangzhou Ballet. La Sylphide, I'm seeing that as well next week. Looking forward to that.
Yes.
And if you're going to let me read things, the text needs to be slightly bigger than 3 points.
Okay.
That's something else. I don't know when.
Then it's next week. It's
next week.
Next week.
I wanted to be more specific. Oh, 18th, 19th, and 20th at 8 p.m. Salle Wilfried Pelletier, Place des Arts.
Cool. Allison, Elizabeth, Gavin, Gabrielle, Dominic, Bettina, Julie, who's been off in the background, thank you all very, very much. This has been Movement Museum, where we talk about dance in Montreal on the radio. We'll catch you all next week.